You're listening to the Alan Gray Podcast. I'm Misha Townsend, a specialist in the Manco distribution team and your host for this episode. Wimbledon, the world's oldest and arguably most famous tennis tournament, was held in July. As it tends to do every year, it sparked conversations about the greatest players in the sport, past and present, including the iconic Roger Federer. His remarkable career offers an important lesson. Success does not mean being right every time. While he won nearly 80% of the singles matches he played, he only won 54% of the points during those matches. Despite losing almost half the points he played, he went on to build one of the greatest careers in tennis history. This analogy is one that we often refer back to when emphasizing that investors do not need to be right all the time. Even the very best still get it wrong. Positive long-term outcomes are achieved when the gains from successful decisions outweigh the losses from the unsuccessful ones. To discuss how this idea plays out in our long-term investment thinking, I'm joined by portfolio manager Tim Acker, who manages a portion of Alan Gray's equity, balanced and stable portfolios. Welcome, Tim, and thank you so much for joining me today. So July delivered no shortage of sporting action. We've had Wimbledon, as mentioned, and of course, plenty of football with the World Cup. Were there any performances or moments that particularly stood out for you, either because they were entertaining or because they reflected a quality that resonates with the way that you think about investing?
So I'm not the biggest football fan, but I did obviously follow the World Cup. So I'm sure some of the super fans are going to disagree with me here. But when I watch the soccer games, it always feels to me like there's quite a lot of randomness in the outcome for any given match, because you only have two or three goals in a match. And they're like a few split seconds where, you know, everything could change. So I think of the semi-final between England and Argentina, where England was leading and then Argentina scored two goals in, you know, literally the last few minutes of the match. So if the match had ended 5 minutes earlier, the outcome would have been different. And, you know, maybe that's fine if you have a league where you're playing, you know, multiple matches. But in a tournament, there's only one game and there's a winner, right? So it does feel to me, at least, maybe I'm wrong here, that there's actually quite a lot of randomness in the outcome for any given match. And it does make me think of investing where for any given stock, like, yes, you do all your research, but, you know, there's still lots of things that happen in the world that you couldn't expect. There's lots of noise. And, you know, to some extent, there's an element of randomness as well.
Okay. Well, I'm actually English, so I don't know if you needed to use that one as your example. So many investors, they assume that successful investing is about being right all the time. Why would you say that's not necessarily the case?
There's different ways you can think about this. So the obvious way when you think about, you know, stocks that you got right or wrong, you know, or winning or losing, it's just did the stock go up or down, right? So, and you can just look at the stock price, or, you know, more typically when we're measuring asset managers, we'd be measuring relative to the market. So you can just think of the stocks that went up more than the market, those were the calls you got right, and the ones that, you know, went down or they didn't go up as much as the market were the ones you got wrong. So that's sort of a very simple way you can look at it. But then equally important, or maybe even more important element, is the impact of those decisions. So, you know, a simple framing of that is just how much capital you put behind those ideas. So, you know, you might buy a stock and it goes up, but if it was a very small part of your portfolio, it's not that impactful. Or conversely, you might make a mistake, but if it's very small, actually, it doesn't matter that much. So that weighting, or how much capital you put behind the decisions, is extremely important. So maybe if we take something that's been a smaller position in the fund, something like Sappi, the, you know, the paper and pulp business. So that's a business which has performed very poorly for, you know, partially their own reasons, but also largely external reasons. But despite the share price being down a lot, fortunately, it hasn't attracted, you know, that materially from the returns for clients, because it was quite a small position in the fund. Even when we bought the share initially, obviously, we thought it was attractive at the time, but we did recognize that there were lots of risks, right? So in recognition of those risks, we definitely limited the position size, which meant that when things unfortunately did go wrong, it didn't detract as much from client performance.
So you mentioned sort of impact, and it's about sort of how much capital that you actually have invested in those ideas that either win or lose. What would you say matters more? The percentage of investments that actually work, or then the magnitude of the outcomes when they do?
Yeah, it's hard to say. They're obviously both important, and I think you can have different approaches. So maybe just talking about the percentage first, a misperception people might have here is that your percentage really doesn't have to be that high. So even the sort of absolute best investors in the world, you know, over their career might get 6 or 7 out of 10 right. So 60 or 70%, you know, of their calls need to be right. So you can still afford to make quite a lot of mistakes, actually. That's definitely true for ourselves as well. And there are different reasons for that. You know, markets are quite efficient and it's hard to beat the average and you know, all these things. But even if you look, as I say, at the best investors around the world, you know, getting 6 or 7 out of 10 right, and so stocks going up, you know, it can still lead to a really good outcome. But then, as you say, the magnitude is obviously very important as well. It's maybe the part that's less appreciated. And it probably comes down to your approach and your philosophy, and different managers can have different approaches. To take an extreme in venture capital, which is not what we do, but just as an example, you know, people often say you can get 1 out of 10 right, and that can be good enough. If that one stock you pick or that new startup you pick, you know, ends up being the next Facebook or the next OpenAI, you know, then it doesn't matter that the other 9 out of 10, you know, go bust, because that more than pays for all your losers and you actually end up doing really well. Obviously, the world we invest in public stocks is a bit different, and Allan Gray tends to be quite conservative, so and we don't like getting things wrong, so we try and limit the amount of losers. So we are very focused on the downside and not losing too much money when we do get things wrong. So, you know, we're quite focused when we're looking at companies on things like, are the earnings sustainable? You know, typically or often we might buy a company that's maybe not growing that much, and you know, maybe the upside is not that attractive, but it could be paying quite a high dividend yield. And in that case, you know, even if you don't end up making a lot of money, your downside is actually quite limited. So it really, I think, does come down to your approach and what you're trying to achieve.
So you said, you know, a good hit rate might be 60 or 70% for a good asset manager. And it's funny because hit rate is something that people seem to focus on, but from what you're saying, it's maybe not the be all and end all. You also mentioned downsides. So some people refer to this idea of asymmetric outcomes in investing, or, you know, skewing the portfolio in your favor. What would this mean for you and for Allan Gray in a portfolio context?
Yeah, so just on that sort of hit rate you mentioned, it's also interesting to just invert that idea. So if you're getting 6 out of 10 right, it doesn't mean you're getting 4 out of 10 wrong, right? Which does feel quite like quite a lot. And it's probably, investing is maybe a little bit unique in that sense, right? You know, if you think, if I was a surgeon, not a portfolio manager, and I told you, you know, 4 out of 10 of my operations go wrong, you'd probably be a little bit worried and I'd probably lose my job, or, you know, there might be a malpractice lawsuit waiting for me. So investing is not like that, right? So you don't necessarily have to have this very high hit rate. But then, as you said, sort of, it can be asymmetric, right? So, and again, there's different approaches, right? So one approach might be to make sure that when you do have winners, they have to be really, really big winners. So those can be things like making sure you hold onto your winners long enough. So when you buy a company that goes up a lot, you probably shouldn't sell it too quickly. You should probably hold on and be willing to have a larger position size, so it ends up being more meaningful in your portfolio. But it could also be on the downside. Maybe you're more focused there to make sure that when you get something wrong, it doesn't end up costing you too much. So our approach there, you know, as I mentioned earlier, is more around sort of the initial selection. So that's something that's very important for us, is buying the kinds of companies where we inherently think there isn't that much downside. So that's a very big focus in our investment approach. A different element is what you do if something does go wrong, because obviously, you know, things change and you don't always make the right decisions. So, you know, some investors are, for example, very focused on cutting their losers if something does go wrong, to make sure that they never have sort of a very material drawdown. And that's obviously something we try and do as well, but you don't always get it right.
So you mentioned not always getting it right, and then sort of knowing when to sell, maybe if an investment thesis or an idea hasn't played out in the way that we thought it would. How then do you distinguish between a genuine mistake and simply being early on an investment thesis? So we often say we're contrarian investors, and we are often willing to look different from the market for a period of time. But how do you manage that?
Yeah, so the jokes people sometimes make, especially about value investors, I guess, is, you know, what is the definition of a long-term investment? It's a short-term investment that didn't work out, right? So so the danger, especially, I think, if you're a value type investor, or if you're sort of a more long-term investor, is that you buy a stock and it doesn't go your way, the stock price declines, or the results are not as good as you hoped. And then you say, no, no, it's fine. Don't worry. I'm a long-term investor. I'm just going to wait. Things are going to turn around eventually. The market is wrong. The people are missing something. So that's the danger. And that's when, you know, people talk about value traps, for example, as you get stuck in those kind of scenarios. But then on your question, so how do you know whether it was right or whether you were just early? This is obviously something we spend a lot of time on in the investment team. It's the most time actually of anything. And there's no simple answer. There's no simple sort of rule you can apply. Like in this case, you were just early or you should just wait. So you have to evaluate case by case. There are different things you can do. So one thing is to not let yourself be overly guided by the share price. So just because you buy a stock and the share price, you know, doesn't go up, it might go down, doesn't necessarily mean you made the wrong decision. So we typically have a longer time horizon. So on a day-to-day basis, there's lots of noise, there's headlines, there's all kinds of things driving stock prices. So we wouldn't be overly concerned about that. And we wouldn't let that, you know, overly influence what we decide to do. But something we do try and incorporate is when you're making that initial decision to buy a stock, you need to have an investment thesis of why are you doing it? You know, what is your investment case? What do you think the key variables are in the business that you're going to track? And then you need to stick to that, right? So if you think the company's going to grow sales and gain market share, then that would obviously be something that we're going to be tracking very closely. And if that doesn't happen, you know, that would be quite a big concern for us. So you do have a danger of, you know, what people sometimes call thesis drift, where your initial thesis doesn't play out and then you come up with a new thesis or some new idea of, you know, why it might still be a good idea. And that can often be quite dangerous. So you want to be quite cautious on that. And then there are things you can build into your process, right? So, you know, you want something like a good peer review process. You want to constantly be revisiting the investment case. So you make the initial decision and then, you know, subsequently the share price might go up or down, but then you want to constantly be relooking at the investment case and saying, you know, should we still be holding the stock? Has something changed? Should we reassess? Maybe there's a better alternative. We're usually not overly focused on what the rest of the market is thinking, but it can be useful to understand, you know, why a share price is behaving in the way that it is. And maybe sort of a topical example of that is AB InBev, the beer company, is, you know, one of our biggest holdings. And over the last few years, many of these alcohol-related stocks, so spirits or beer, have come under pressure because, you know, many investors or, you know, the market is concerned that this trend of younger people not drinking as much has sort of, you know, been a very topical thing. So in that case, you know, we've very consciously known that this is a reason why the stock hasn't done well. And it's something then we've done subsequently our own research on, and we've concluded that we're less worried about that. Not to say it's not a trend at all, but we just don't think it's as material as the market is worried about. So then you can be quite specific and identify this is the reason why we think the market is missing something and why we're still happy to own a share.
Okay, so it sounds like it's a very thorough process. And I'm glad you mentioned some of the elements there. As investors, we find often can focus on the outcomes, but I know you've spoken before about the importance of judging the process rather than the result. Can you unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think that's a critical thing to talk about. So investing is really just making decisions, right? So, and in any sort of decision-making science, you know, you can split things between the process and the outcome. You know, people often use gambling analogies with investing, which is maybe rightly or wrongly so. And people often compare it to poker, which I think is sort of similar in many ways. If you have a good hand and the odds are in your favor and you look around the table and you think like, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm, you know, 90% sure I have the best hand here, it makes sense to bet quite heavily. But then even in that case, you might still not win, right? And does that mean you made a mistake even though you lost that hand? Probably not, right? Because you should probably make the same decision again next time, given the same information. And it can be similar in investing. You should really focus on the process and the decision-making, not the outcome, because that's what you can control. And there is a certain element of randomness and noise and things that you can't anticipate. It can always happen. When you're making an investment, for example, you know, to use the opposite example, maybe I think we all can think of examples where someone you know buys a stock without doing any research, right? They just sort of like randomly pick something based on a whim and the stock goes up and they say like, look, I'm a genius. You know, I made such a good investment. Where in that case, I think clearly you would say, even though the outcome was good, the process was probably not good, right? So definitely internally, what we focus on is the process and the decision making. You know, one, because that's what we can control, but also that's what we can improve on over time. And that is the way we're measuring ourselves as an investment team internally. But the one danger with that is it can be tricky to split, and you have to be honest with yourself, which is not always easy to do. And we do, of course, know that the thing that ultimately matters to clients is the outcome, right? So that's the ultimate scorecard at the end of the day. And clients don't really care about what the process was if the outcome is not good. So that is also a fair point.
Do you have any examples of where it was a good investment decision, we followed that process, but it did ultimately end up in a poor outcome?
Yeah, so I'll give you one example. And I'll caveat it. It can be hard to be honest with yourself. So you can always fool yourself and say like, oh, I actually made the right decision, even though it didn't go in my way, right? So, but in this case, I do think we did follow the right process. So if you think, you know, way back when Ramaphosa was elected leader of the ANC, it was end of 2016, beginning 2017, there was this phrase people used, maybe some of the listeners will remember, Ramaphoria, where there was all this optimism about South Africa and so on. So many of the local stocks, including the banks, did really, really well in 2017, 2018. You know, we sold many of those holdings. And then subsequently, when things sort of didn't improve as quickly as people had hoped, that the banks, especially the bank share prices, declined quite a lot. So we bought quite a lot of the banks, the South African banks, in 2019 after there had been this decline. So we had done all our work and we thought the valuations were very attractive. And we thought this was a good use of client capital. But then the thing we didn't see coming, of course, was COVID, right? So, you know, just about a year after we bought these shares, COVID happened and we went into lockdown and, you know, all these things. And the bank share prices fell, you know, dramatically by sort of, you know, big double-digit percentages. So if I look back on that, you know, did we make the wrong decision at the time based on the information we had? Or, you know, would I make a different decision if I had to go back? I probably wouldn't make a different decision, right? I think given the information we had, I think we made the right call. What you could criticize us for is probably not reacting quickly enough when COVID started happening and there was all the initial data about the pandemic. So for sure, we could have changed the position probably faster, I think is a fair criticism. But I think that in that case, the initial decision, the process was fine, even though the outcome wasn't what we wanted to be.
So that was an example of something that didn't play out as expected. And then you mentioned that maybe we hadn't acted quick enough in that specific example. What is our process for deciding when we sell or hold, or on the flip side, when we actually increase a position?
So similar to sort of how you know if it's right or wrong, like it really is case by case. And this is really what the investment team spends a lot of time doing, right? So we have to know the individual companies really well. You have to have sort of an initial investment case based on the fundamentals of the business, on, you know, why you own the share. And then you have to track all those metrics and see if things are sort of going your way or not. But then in addition to that, there's also sort of an emotional side. So I think you have to be humble, right? You don't want to be wedded to your investment decision. I think it can be extremely dangerous. It's very easy in many professions to sort of get overconfident and say, okay, we did all this research, you know, we feel so clever about this and the share price is going against us, but don't worry, we're going to be right in the long run. So that sort of thinking can be very dangerous. So you have to sort of be open to changing your mind. And some of this also comes to process. So the things like the culture in the team. So you want sort of a culture where junior analysts feel free to challenge the portfolio managers. You want to have mechanisms in your process where you're reviewing the investment case frequently and people can speak up if they feel you're making a mistake. But then also maybe specifically on your question of sort of increasing position. So a lot of that also comes to price and valuation and margin of safety. So, you know, we might often initiate a position in a share at a certain position size in the portfolio. And then if for whatever reason the share price declines a bit and we actually think the value hasn't changed, then, you know, that's a good thing. We wouldn't be upset about that. And if we really think the value hasn't declined, we'd rather increase the positions because the margin of safety, you know, could be bigger now.
How do you decide whether an opportunity should be high conviction position or a smaller holding in the portfolio?
Yeah, so there are different ways one can approach the position sizing in the portfolio. I think often people think, you know, you just sort of list your ideas and the one you're most excited about or you think there's the most upside would be the biggest share in your portfolio. And in a way, it's almost the opposite approach maybe makes a bit more sense where you start with what do you think the downside is. So if there's a share where you think there's attractive upside, but more importantly, you think the downside is not as great, then that's probably a better candidate to be a bigger position in a fund. So if we look at our, you know, many of our funds today, we have AB InBev as a big holding. So that's a company where we feel there's actually not that much downside. So it's quite a good candidate to have a bigger position in the fund. There are different, you know, inputs as well in the position sizing. So we have internal risk limits, for example, based on sort of various characteristics for a company. So maybe a good example to bring in here is something like Sasol. So it's a share which we've owned sort of on and off, you know, for many years. But over the last few years, even though we've been quite excited about Sasol and we thought there was a lot of upside, we did also recognize that there are quite a lot of risks with the company, right? So they're obviously very exposed to the oil price, but they also have a lot of debt, which means that even though we think the upside's attractive, we're definitely limiting the position size in the portfolio. And there have been times when it's been a good thing that the position size has been limited because the share price has gone down. But then over the last year, for example, when the oil price went up, we were very fortunate to have a share like Sasol in the portfolio. So it did contribute very nicely to performance. So even though there were these risks, it still made sense to have the share in the portfolio, but just add a smaller position size.
So if we think of the balance fund as an example, that is more than just a collection of shares. There's obviously different asset class in there, bonds, cash. There's the offshore elements as well. How do decisions across these different asset classes create opportunities for these asymmetric outcomes or to find areas where there's maybe a bigger margin of safety?
We've been talking about stocks now, but the same principles apply across, you know, whether it's bonds or commodities or local or offshore. So it's really the same sort of thinking across asset classes. And if we, you know, this framing I mentioned earlier about sort of getting 6 out of 10 right, you know, it's fine if you think for an individual stock, like what are your odds of getting that decision right? But then in a broader fund, especially something like a balanced fund, you want to have enough different bets that are uncorrelated. So you can actually get sort of that averaging, you know, working for you. And the important element there is that these bets ideally do need to be uncorrelated. So if you're buying sort of 5 different shares, which you think are cheap, but they're all exposed to the same risk, like let's say they're all gold mining companies, right? And you think all 5 of them are cheap because you're so bullish on the gold price. You know, if you get that wrong, then all 5 are going to be wrong. Then the sort of 60% doesn't really help you, right? So in a balanced fund or, you know, really any of the funds, actually, we really like diversifying, not just sort of, you know, in terms of number of holdings, but really in terms of sort of different risks. Things that are really uncorrelated is, you know, quite a valuable thing in a multi-asset fund. And then a separate part is, you know, we've been talking about things like margin of safety and limiting the downside risk, you know, in different ways. So that really is quite a big focus in our investment approach is it's just limiting the downside risk. And that plays into our thinking on different asset classes as well. And it also plays into the interplay between different assets. So maybe a simple example is in a multi-asset fund, we would hold South African bonds, but we would also hold shares like South African banks. And those things are quite correlated. They tend to move in the same way. So we would think of that relationship when we're deciding how much to allocate between them.
And would you say that process is the same across all of the funds? I know we mentioned the balance fund, but would this play out in stable or the equity fund or any of the other ones we manage?
It's very, very similar. The investment philosophy in general at Allan Gray and the way we pick the individual shares is very, very similar across the different funds. So that's why you would also, when you're looking at the holdings of individual shares in, you know, whether it's the equity fund or the balance fund or the stable fund, they would typically be very similar. You might see some differences. So you can imagine in a lower risk fund like the stable fund, you would imagine that the kind of shares you would own might be slightly different. So there might be shares which, even though the upside is not that great, it could be sort of moderate upside, but with very low downside risk, you know, that could be a good candidate for the stable fund, for example, even though you might not necessarily own that share in the same position size in the equity fund, for example. So there could be some slight nuances due to your view on the risk.
Okay. So you mentioned risk a few times there as well. So obviously, We're looking to get returns for our clients, but risk is also important to us in managing that. So do you maybe have an example of where your conviction in an investment was high, but maybe due to some other risk factor or maybe how it fit in with the rest of the portfolio, you had to constrain or limit that position size?
Yeah, there are a few examples we can mention here, but one that I think is just extremely important in the South African universe is Naspers and Prosus. So this is something we've often spoken to about clients, given that Naspers and Prosus are, you know, very big shares in the SA universe. So together, you know, they used to be capped at 12% of the index. Now they're slightly smaller, but still, you know, very big weight in the index. So for any South African investor, it's sort of a big, or any manager as well, it's a big call on, you know, whether you own these shares or not. And we've felt for the last few years that we like the company. So the big underlying exposure is obviously Tencent, the Chinese internet company. So we've felt for the number of years now that we think Tencent is attractive and, you know, therefore Naspers and Prosus is attractive as well. But that being said, there are some very big risks that are quite hard to quantify. So you have this big investment in China. There's an, you know, somewhat uncertain regulatory environment. It's unclear what the Chinese government is going to do. It's not like a Western country where you really sort of have recourse to the courts and so on. The Chinese Communist Party can, to some extent, do what they want. And then on top of that, you've got this whole geopolitical thing of there's a trade war going between the US and China. You know, Donald Trump wakes up tomorrow, he tweets something about tariffs or some rule about who's allowed to own what, or the Chinese government decides they don't want foreign investments holding, you know, something happens with Taiwan. There are lots of different scenarios you can imagine where even though you like the underlying business, the investment might not end up going in your favor. And these are hard things to predict, right? You can do your spreadsheet as much as you want and you can study all these things. And, you know, we try and sort of think of different scenarios and what might happen. But at the end of the day, this is something that's quite hard to quantify. So how do we manage those kind of risks? Because there are lots of companies that have these kind of risks. The most important tool we have is position size, right? So in all our funds, we have these internal risk limits. But even within that limits, the portfolio managers think quite carefully about, you know, even if we think a share is attractive, what is the right position size? So for something like Naspers and Prosus, we've limited that position size just because we think there are these big sort of questions that we don't know what's going to happen.
Okay, so I guess it's fair to say that it's not just the valuation, it's the overall risks and then your level of conviction, all of that comes together. To get the perfect position size. Knowing that it is likely that you're going to make some less than ideal investment decisions, how do you become comfortable with being wrong, let's say 40% of the time or for an extended period of time?
You know, whether you are a portfolio manager managing a fund, or whether you're a financial advisor, or whether you are, you know, a retail client investing your own money, it's actually the same answer. You have the same issue, and it really comes down to managing your emotions, right? So it's such a key thing in investing. As, you know, as much as you can study all the theory and how to value companies and all these things, just managing your emotions is such an impactful part of the investment process. So for us, when we're picking shares, you know, it's back to some of the things I mentioned earlier. It's sort of like not falling in love with a position, you know, being willing to change your mind, being open to change your mind, not being overconfident. But then also building in processes to help you with those things. So having sort of frequent reviews on stocks, for example, having people challenge your position. So those are all sort of really important things when things go wrong. But then also you just have to realize that, you know, sometimes the investment case takes a time to play out, right? So we know we have a longer term time horizon. So we know there's going to be noise in the interim. You might buy a stock and it might go down initially and you might still be confident on the long run. So you shouldn't expect it to just go in a straight line and for everything to just work out automatically. If you're a contrarian, you know, type manager, then by definition it means you're going against the consensus and people are sometimes going to think you're stupid or you're making mistakes and they're going to criticize you. And you just have to be fine with that. Like, that's something you have to accept. Like, don't be surprised if it happens. Like, you should expect that's going to happen, right?
Do you have an example of one of those investments where we did look wrong for quite a period of time and then it actually played out and you looked very clever at the end of it?
Yeah, I like those examples. No, I'll give you one of each actually. So I'll give you one maybe where we got it right and when we got it wrong. One is Investec. So this is a share we've owned, you know, for call it the last 10 years or so. And for the first few years, things didn't go right. And, you know, one could maybe debate on whether we actually were too early. or whether it just took time to play out. But sort of the business was not performing particularly well. There was some questions around governance, and it was a complicated structure with lots of kind of things going on. But regardless, the share price sort of wasn't doing that well. And then about 5 or 6 years or so ago, there were some changes in management, but also the group structure just got simplified a lot. They unbundled the asset management business. The business became a lot simpler. The performance started improving. And actually, over the last few years, it's been a really good share, right? It's actually done really, really well. And it's something when, if you look back, you know, quite a few years, it was quite unpopular, right? There sort of weren't that many managers where you could really convince that this was a good share to own. So it's something we held throughout that time, and we added, you know, to the position over time, and ended up working out quite well for clients. Now, if you look back, it seems sort of fairly obvious, but at the time, it definitely wasn't obvious. And there was definitely something we got a lot of questions about. The opposite example would be Life Healthcare, the hospital group. So it's the reason I mentioned that is it's a share we've owned over a similar period. So we've also owned it for the last 10 years or so. For the most part, it hasn't been a good investment. The underlying business has done okay. It hasn't been completely terrible, but I guess, you know, similar to many other South African businesses that are largely exposed to the middle class, is it's just been a really tough operating environment, right? Most people who can go to private hospitals, you know, have medical aid. So it's sort of, by definition, the middle class in South Africa, you know, and at various points in the investment case, we sort of looked at the business and we said, like, if there's some recovery to kind of what we thought a normal level would be, then the business would do quite well. But you just never really saw that recovery, right? It was just a kind of a slow decline as the economy was not growing, and you had sort of fixed cost escalations, you know, against you in terms of your cost base. So even though we did sort of, you know, relook at the investment case quite frequently as the share price was not doing well, every time we concluded that actually things are still fine, there's still some recovery coming. Throughout COVID, it was obviously, you know, the data got a bit noisy because of COVID and lockdowns, et cetera. So that maybe hid the underlying trend a bit. And if we look back on it now, you know, it's sort of a slow decline over time. It seems obvious that at some point you should have cut the position more aggressively, and it seems like an easy decision now. But then if I think back on those meetings where we sat and we actually did sort of relook at the investment case, it didn't seem obvious at that time. Right? So that's in the case where we made the wrong decision.
Okay, so we've spoken about a few different things today. We've mentioned it's not just focusing on getting things right, but it's about the impact of those decisions. You also spoke about having a robust process and focusing on, was the process correct, as well as managing emotions. If listeners remember only one thing from today's discussion, what should it be?
Yeah, so we brought up this idea of the process versus the outcome. And while I do think that's extremely important, just acknowledge it's very hard to do from the outside, right? If you're a financial advisor or you're a retail client, the only thing you see is the outcome, right? It's very hard for you to actually see the process on the inside and to judge that. But the one practical thing, you know, maybe investors can do when they assessing any manager is, you know, typically people open the fact sheet and they look at the top holdings and they see, okay, the manager owns this share and that share, and they look at the names. But I would encourage people to look at the percentages a bit more, the position sizes in the fund, because really that tells you a much more important story. So if you look at our top 10 shares in our equity fund, for example, you know, we own Woolworths, for example, it's roughly a 2% position in the fund. You know, we often get a lot of clients questions about Woolworths, maybe because it's a business people know quite well and, you know, can be controversial, but it's only 2% of the fund. So it's actually not that important. You know, a way, way more impactful decision is whether we own AB InBev at an 8% position or a 4% position, right? That's way more impactful on what the outcome to clients will actually be. So I think paying attention to position sizing, you know, is maybe something that's underrated.
That brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining me, Tim, and thank you for listening. Some of the key takeaways for me were that the difference between a good investor and a great investor is often not the number of winners, but what they do when they find one. And yes, being right matters, but position sizing determines how much it matters. Over time, your process is going to matter more than any single result. So long-term investing is about stacking the odds in your favor and allowing that small edge to compound over time. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to podcast@alangray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Misha Townsend. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us, all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you, most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Alan Gray, long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.